ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When you want to be stopped in your tracks.
I'm running to shoot it. It's 50-50. You can catch his gun or he shoot you.
When you want to know the truth.
She was brainwashing her from the start.
We're here to investigate.
Something's gone wrong, big time.
Search Background Briefing Podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvallis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri Country in Melbourne.
And I'm Melissa Clark, joining you from Ngunnawal Country in Canberra. I'm sitting in the chair for Fran today. So as always, big shoes to fill.
Okay, your shoes are excellent, Mel, usually sneakers because we all know you love to run. Mel, we've had so many excellent questions in our inbox recently. First of all, thank you to everyone who has sent them because we are being overwhelmed, and that's in a good way. Like, I'm using the word positively. We really, really, of course, appreciate them. Unfortunately, though, just caveat, we cannot answer them all. It's not possible. So I'm really sorry if we haven't answered yours, but that doesn't mean we won't get to them at some point. We're going to give them the space they deserve. We've been doing these regularly now, and I know you all like that, which is why we're getting more questions. Like, it's like a feedback loop. But Mel, we will start this pod telling you what's going on in the world, because quite a lot is going on. Of course, the big thing yesterday we discussed with Annabelle in our regular episode of The Party Room is the announcement in relation to the CGT tax, but politics hasn't really stopped this week. It's actually been one of the bigger weeks of politics I've seen for a while.
It really has, especially when you consider that Parliament hasn't sat this week, and often you get the big developments when party leaders are getting down to the final details of negotiations to get legislation through, and that's when sometimes the big concessions are made. But this time it's been that consultation away from the Parliament that is behind the government's decision to have this back down on some of the key points of contention around its tax reform. So it's come back with this bit of a blitz to try and sell its reshaping or its response to the criticism and say, look, our tax reform plans are still great. They're still going to make change for the housing affordability and accessibility crisis. Businesses aren't going to collapse because of changing tax rates, but we just made some very small changes here. And look, I think it's been really interesting, PK, because the government's clearly made some strategic concessions here on the areas that it thinks were biting the most, treatment of startups in both the sort of tech and bio sector world, the issue around discretionary testamentary trusts that the coalition was really hammering very hard by describing them as death taxes, even though they weren't death taxes. So these are the areas that the government has sought to make a move on. But I'm not sure how much it's going to move the dial. For those who are campaigning against this, their concerns are much bigger than just these elements. I mean, the business community has welcomed the change in some of the thresholds around what are classified as small businesses. But ultimately, the loudest voices want the whole reform package gone, so they're not going to be satisfied. Those who are supportive of the changes might see this as, at worst, a back down, at best a strategic manoeuvre to try and at least limit the friction to get it through. But I'm not convinced that this is going to change anyone in the public's mind. What do you think, PK?
No, not immediately, but it takes the sting out of the most contentious elements. I think the sort of turnover for business up to $10 million is actually really sound policy. And I think that will go well when people realise. So that means a lot of businesses to be covered. That, I think, does travel well. But your point more broadly is correct. Yeah, but what's the point of a Labor government if they back down on all of it? I mean, what is the point of them then? They cannot, having made what is a very, very controversial decision to break election promises because, as they've argued, it is necessary to shake up the housing market, to intergenerationally shift things, to move to a model of taxing passive income more than active labour income. You cannot say all those things and then backflip on everything. In fact, in some ways, they've backflipped more than probably, you know, some would have wanted them to already. So I just don't think they can get away with that either, because I think you lose. I mean, I'll give you an example because I'm older than you. Only a bit, but I am older than you.
Fractionally.
But I am. And I recall the back down on the emissions trading scheme that famously Kevin Rudd did a bit of a backflip because they were getting very bad polling on it.
Unfortunately, and it really, that means I'm also old too, because I also remember that.
Well,
you've aged both of us.
But it precipitated him getting rolled as Prime Minister. Now, I don't want to go through the weeds, but there were lots of reasons he got rolled as Prime Minister in terms of, you know, the way he was governing internally. But that was a really big turning point. Mm. The reason it was bad was because the public was like, what do you stand for? So they couldn't go and do something bold.
Yeah, he described it as the greatest moral challenge of our time, and then he backed away from it. So having set it up as this great big challenge that needed to be addressed, that was the reason for the government being in power, you then can't walk away and say we're not going to do it, right?
Correcto mundo. And so now that they've done this, they have to stay the course. They've already backflipped, some would argue, too much. They have to now argue for this thing. They have to sell this thing. Now, maybe it's unsellable. I'm not sure, though. I think when the dividend, and we talked about that yesterday, me and Annabelle, you know, when you get the big fat tax cut that perhaps they will have to look at bringing forward, let's see how the economy's going, all that stuff. When that's received, perhaps the public will see things differently. When you can prove that the changes you've made are going to change your life materially, which hasn't been proven yet, but when you can, maybe that proposition changes.
What about, though, the tactical process of needing to get this legislation through Parliament? Because the concessions that we've had here are to some of the public debate that's going on, but ultimately not where the votes are needed in the Senate. That's with the Greens. And the concessions they're pushing for are for greater limits on negative gearing. But we're not seeing any hints from the government that they're willing to make concessions on that front, which they do actually need the Greens to come on board to get it through the Senate. So what do you make of that approach? Do you think they're just holding the line, assuming the Greens will ultimately fall into place and vote for it no matter what? Or do you think there'll be more concessions on the sheer need to get it through the Senate still to come?
I wouldn't rule out more changes because, you know, any negotiation, the Greens have to walk out with something, right? Like, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles, or at least to save face. But I've said consistently, and always happy to be wrong anyway, but I have spoken to enough people to figure that the Greens will pass this. I just really believe they will. I don't think they can stand in the way of something that is a more progressive taxation system, which is what this is. This is a more left-leaning version of taxation that they are moving towards. The Greens, more of the harder left, but I just don't know how they can get away with it with their own supporters. Don't forget what got them unstuck last time, right? What got them unstuck is being too recalcitrant, holding back too much. So I reckon it'll pass and there won't be significantly more changes, but, you know, I could be wrong. I just don't see it.
Can we go from one big deal to another big deal?
Oh, the biggest deal.
The biggest deal in the world at the moment right now?
Let's go to this deal, which is a very friendless deal, can I say, in terms of the political class in the US, including Republicans. So we didn't get to this on the regular podcast yesterday with Annabelle Crabb because there was a lot going on, and you can catch up on that analysis after this. The episode is linked in the show notes. But it's officially in effect. There's already traffic being reported in the Strait of Hormuz. This is a good thing. There's no denying that. But it's a 14-point memorandum. But it is, as far as I can see, an absolute dud deal for the US and the Western world, is it not?
There are an enormous amount of concessions here that I think would have been conceivable to think that the US would make prior to this whole outbreak of conflict. Yet now we have the US government signing up to an MOU that makes commitments around hundreds of billions of dollars in reconstruction funds for Iran, as vague as those details are, that talk about lifting the sanctions in place, particularly on financial restrictions on the Iranian regime's assets. There's completely key questions around how to treat or how to respond to the core issue of Iran's nuclear program. I mean, it reiterates that Iran won't procure or develop nuclear weapons, but everything else is left to this next 60-day period to negotiate. Given what we know, given how long we know it took the Obama administration, for example, to negotiate the last agreement with Iran around nuclear material, its potential ambition, how to deal with all the potential loopholes or misunderstandings or caveats that might need to be put in place. It's very hard to see how this is going to work. And we haven't even mentioned Lebanon yet. Now, it clearly says that there must be an immediate and permanent cessation of military operations in Lebanon, yet we're already seeing Benjamin Netanyahu continue to assert his right to continue to strike back where Hezbollah is active in Lebanon. But there are very, very different views here about what is seen as a reasonable response and what is not. And I think what we're starting to see is what had been the sort of quiet mutters and the leaks about the relationship between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu and how strained that relationship was becoming. I think it's now front and centre, given the latest comments from J.D. Vance, the vice president. I know you've been watching it very closely, PK.
I have been watching it, obsessed. I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed generally by J.D. Vance. I don't know if anyone knows this on this podcast because it's not like my main bread and butter to talk about it. But yeah, I'm obsessed with this man. I just think the way he pitches himself to different audiences, and he's such a chameleon of a character. I find him so interesting. J.D. Vance, who's obviously positioning for his run for president, but he's terribly unpopular, particularly with women. J.D. Vance said this thing, like, so he's the chief sort of seller of this deal, like out in the public sphere, and I don't know how well he's going with that because it's not particularly popular.
You heard Donald Trump say that he's going to send J.D. Vance out to sell it because he thinks it's going to be a hard task and he can be the one to carry the blame if it doesn't go down well. Trump is openly saying this about his own vice president.
Which is the thing about Trump, right? Like, you know, he says the quiet bit out loud. So J.D. Vance saying, you know, with Israel's objection to this, that because Israel's obviously not happy to see that Iran is having, you know, their assets unfrozen and being able to have access to money without much of a kind of formalized deal, it seems, that, you know, they better basically stay in their box because no one likes them anymore apart from the US. They're very unpopular and the US is a superpower. I mean, he's right, by the way. They are friendless. That's what's happened since the war in Gaza, I think, increasingly. That is, they are an isolated state. The US is their main ally. And he's saying, you're not going to get anywhere with us. And I think that is such a fascinating shift in the MAGA world. Anyway, let's just park that and talk about one more thing that we just must talk about before we get to people's questions. Mel, I have to just build a story because you know how I am. It's 7 minutes to airtime for Afternoon Briefing. And ping, bing, bing, people are sending me this video, which is Gina Rinehart giving a toy bulldozer to Pauline Hanson on stage at a News Corporation Future Townsville Forum. It's been put on by the Townsville Bulletin. She's making noise of a tractor, which is kind of obviously comical, full stop, if anyone does that, and referencing Elon Musk and his Doge vibes. And I'm like, is this real? And then we get it clipped up and we play it on the show and it, you know, goes bananas last night. Wow, what on earth was that? And how can that be? Maybe I'm wrong, but I just can't. I think Doge, does that help One Nation? Am I missing something?
It's very, if you haven't seen it, you do need to watch it because I feel like we would be accused of making it up if it hadn't actually happened. Gina Rinehart literally hands over a toy bulldozer to Pauline Hanson there and says, you can be just like Elon Musk. He had a chainsaw. I'm giving you a bulldozer. That's what we need. It's an extraordinary scene to see one of the wealthiest women in the world, certainly the wealthiest person in Australia, have such a comical approach to encouraging this emergent right-wing populist figure in Pauline Hanson to try and build and capitalise on her growing political strength with her ideas, but in a very comic strip kind of way. It's such a bizarre clash to see. I can't imagine allusions to Trump are helpful to One Nation at a time when it is trying to turn, you know, curiosity and soft support into party membership and votes at the ballot box. But then again, I think there's a lot of unusual things we might not have predicted several months ago. So I'm sort of reluctant to draw any hard conclusion about, is this good? Is this bad? I think the political atmosphere at the moment is one that's really hard to predict, and it's hard to know what is going to land well and what's going to land poorly. We'll see where this one is.
Oh, Mel, it's such a fascinating time to be alive. Shall we head into question time?
Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I'll give a call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. And our first question comes from Vish.
While the Labor Party is far more united and disciplined than the right-angled love triangle of the Coalition and One Nation, do you think this approach harms rather than helps their case? The thought bubble of even having debate against party direction makes diversity in their 94-seat a majority meaningless if they're all just one voice, especially if that's the voice that's just broken an election promise. Around the world, we see charismatic and populist leaders winning the public over. As I said, they're drastically different from the status quo. In the Labour Party, all are falling in line behind a PM who is regularly failing to sell their policies regardless of their merit. My two cents is it will make change in leadership even harder for them if they continue to stagnate or dip further in the polls, as the next leader won't have much to differentiate themselves from the current PM. Love to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
Excellent question, Vish. I'm going to throw it to you, Mel. What do you reckon?
It is a really great question, Vish, and I think it's one that the Labor Party has grappled with a little bit, but indeed might become a little more prominent if we start to see the political landscape evolve a bit more. I guess when it comes to the discipline of the Labor Party, we have to consider the structure of the Labor Party and where the debates take place. We certainly don't see debate in caucus, where all the Labor MPs and senators gather together, usually in Canberra at the start of a sitting week, to make decisions. That is not the venue. In the past, historically, that's been the place for really robust debates. It's not at this point in time. There is a lot more that goes on in the sub-level meetings, the factional level meetings, where each faction meets before they all come together at caucus and decide their positions. And then often a lot of arrangement is done between the factional power brokers. So the debate that's taking place is often a level lower than caucus. And then there's also the level above caucus, which is the ministry and the cabinet in particular. And I think part of what's playing into this discipline or lack of caucus as the venue for a big debate is we've got a really big split in this Labor Party between, you know, a lot of very new MPs in this big wave that we had in 2025 that led to the party having this record level of seats in the lower house. And then we also have, particularly at cabinet level, a very experienced, historically a very experienced cabinet where many cabinet ministers served in the previous Rudd-Gillard-Rudd government, had another period in opposition, have come back into government again a second time around with a lot of experience. And I do think there's a really big gulf between the older guard that centre power at cabinet and this broad rank of new MPs and senators who are still learning the craft of Parliament. And I think that sort of divides some of the level of ability for robust debate.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But to the question of, like, is this discipline helping them or not, I think it's a really, like, a good question. And there's no better kind of person to point to, actually, than Ed Husic, who is on the backbench now and, of course, you know, once was a cabinet minister. Clearly raising on Afternoon Briefing with me this very issue, saying too much discipline is going to cause Labor harm at a time where people are no longer looking for cookie cutter politicians that are speaking talking points. Like, that's what he says. Now, I don't know if he's right, as in I can't prove it's right. That's what I really mean to say. But it does resonate with me because I'm looking at the political system, I'm looking at the success of who's getting cut through, and it's not the talking points. And I do a show where backbenchers come on and the ones who read the talking points literally, I've got to say, and I'm just, you know, they might hear this, I don't really care. I often get to the end of it and I think, I don't know if you really did your party or your movement any good today. Like, but others come on and maybe, you know, it doesn't mean they have to break ranks per se, but perhaps express things differently, talk in a way that's more relatable. And I think they are able to make land points better.
What about Vish's question at the end, though, about is it going to be hard for whoever might wish to come after Anthony Albanese if they haven't shown themselves to be different anyway, and if the public doesn't want to see a third term for Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister but might be willing to give Labor another term with another leader at the helm, if there isn't anyone who's sufficiently differentiated themselves? Talk me through your view on this. What do you think about the position of, say, Jim Chalmers, who would have aspirations for the leadership of Prime Minister, is clearly making a big gambit at this point with the tax reform package that he is trying to lead through the Parliament, that they will certainly be judged upon when it comes to polling time. Do voters see a differentiation between a Prime Minister and a Treasurer and then all of the other Cabinet Ministers who are all backing this in? Does it undo their own political aspirations further down the track if there's no differentiation? What do you think the answer is to Vish's question there?
No, I don't think it matters that much. I think we have a nice, neat little Westminster system. We're not a presidential system. I actually don't think it matters. I think what matters is, the brand ultimately matters. I'm not saying candidate doesn't matter at all. Clearly does. But I just don't think you need to be differentiating yourself right now to then be a future leader. Not at all. You do need to have some name recognition. And so there's a few cabinet ministers that are getting there. Jim Chalmers clearly on the high side, but that doesn't mean internally he's the best candidate. You know, like I can tell you, there's lots of discussions about who it might be. Just today, Mark Butler, the health minister, had to sort of fight off some questions about the idea that he's like the heir apparent. Now, the reason he's sort of that way is people report that the prime minister sort of sees him that way, but it's not up to the prime minister, although the left does have the numbers, and that's a whole numbers game. And now I'm going to park this whole question. Our next question comes from Tim.
Tim here from Wurundjeri country. Do you think it's possible that Pauline Hanson's trajectory will to some extent mirror that of Peter Dutton's? Dutton was popular at the midpoint of the last parliament. However, when his lack of policy detail was exposed in the heat of the 2025 election campaign, things came tumbling down and he performed poorly. Hanson's appeal seems to be that she's offering something different at a time when the status quo doesn't seem to be delivering for everyday Australians. While she's revealed some limited policy positions, there's not much detail. Is it possible that they won't stand up to scrutiny in the 2028 election campaign, and the current predictions of a One Nation taking formal opposition status and sweeping in with swathes of seats won't come to fruition?
Tim, this is an excellent question and actually at the centre of the current debate, both off the record and kind of on the record too, depends the forms we're having these discussions. And what I mean by that is that's what the major political parties are currently debating among themselves.
It's a $64 million question, right? Does this support hold until election day?
The scrutiny argument. Mm. Will the increased scrutiny undo her? I know Liberal MPs say that to me. They want more sunlight. Let's put the blowtorch to this like you would the main parties, where we, you know, question them on inconsistencies and you've got a black hole there and you can't pay for that. All of that is about to happen. It's already happening. It will happen more and more. My view is that it will tighten things. It'll peel off support for One Nation. I am pretty certain of that when it's kind of pointy and crunch time. But I'm not certain it'll do all of the work, because I think for some people, vibes are enough and they've become increasingly disinterested in, you know, your black hole and your Parliamentary Budget Office numbers. And what she's harnessing is something deeper in the community, a view and a sentiment which scrutiny is not going to be an answer on. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, there's a huge unknowable factor here, and we won't know until we have a federal election. There are a couple of things, though. You're right that for a lot of people, the sentiment is what matters and what they want expressed, which is current system isn't working. Someone is speaking plainly. They might not have all the answers, but at least they have a view that something needs to be fixed and the current system don't work. Now, does that carry all the way through to, oh, now I actually have to mark my ballot paper? Am I convinced this is the right approach for running the country? That we don't know. We don't know how much it will translate. I mean, you can point to votes translating in the South Australian election in Farrah. You can look at things like branch membership that shows commitment beyond just vibes. And so there's solid evidence to suggest there is strength behind the support for One Nation. But there are some pretty big risks on the downside for One Nation too. We've got 2 years until a federal election. Voter support is pretty soft generally for all parties. So it makes it quite easy for people's opinions to change at short notice. And you can probably point to Peter Dutton and the Coalition's experience of that between the start of the year and the May election that we had, where their fortunes changed greatly. Look, the novelty of Pauline Hanson as a new insurgent figure, does that kind of momentum continue for 2 years unbroken? That'd be a pretty hard ask. Is there another external circumstance that injects itself into the debate between now and another federal election? Donald Trump in the US presidency, anything could happen in the world that really unseats what we think is the current momentum or the current status. So I think it's very, very hard to predict because there are just too many variables in the system right now.
Oh, so many variables, and it's so far away. But, you know, we're seeing a reshaping, and our job as political reporters is to bring to you kind of all of those movements as they happen. Some will be more interested than others. Those of you listening to this podcast have, you know, voted with your feet. You are interested in the movements. You know, it's the economy stupid. It's all about the sentiment and how things are going. As things stand, if there was an election tomorrow, I would be, I'd be pretty nervous if I was the Prime Minister or if I was Angus Taylor, who no one seems to even know really, you know, who this guy is really, like a lot of people don't. So yeah, I'd be pretty uncomfortable. Okay. Dylan has a question. Here he is.
There's an old saying in Australian politics that oppositions don't win elections, government lose them. My question is, do you think the rise of minor parties like One Nation predominantly actually challenge that maxim and make oppositions of any kind actually have to go out there and win votes in order to be competitive, to put themselves forward as the best option at the next election? Or do you think this rise of minor parties and third parties like One Nation is actually creating long-term instability?
What do you reckon, Mel?
Look, I like it, and I think it's still a solid guide, the idea that governments lose elections. Incumbency is really powerful. I think there are a couple of factors here, though. The more the political field is crowded with new players or insurgent players. I mean, One Nation certainly isn't new. They've been around for decades, but they're playing a new role in the political landscape given the growth in their support. But we are seeing less support for the major parties, growing interest in minor, micro parties and independents, of course, as well. That makes the field more crowded. It makes it harder to stand out. It means you don't have as much of a base to rely on, so getting support's harder. And it means parties do need to put more effort into being proactive, into differentiating themselves from a crowded field. If you're a centre-left independent, how do you differentiate yourself from a Greens candidate, a legalised cannabis candidate, perhaps a Teal candidate and a Labor candidate? You're going to have to do a lot more work on it. Now, I think One Nation comes into that environment with a harder task as anyone in trying to challenge an incumbent government. But I just want to make the point that I don't think it's One Nation's rise that's creating instability in this sector. I think they're a product of splintering support anyway. The idea that the political field is getting more crowded and people are less rusted or less tribal, One Nation's rise is a product of that rather than a cause of that instability.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Okay, our next question comes from Claire.
I've noticed that in all the conversations around housing reform, no one has any policies about making a meaningful shift for people that are renting and want to rent long term. We know that from models overseas, if you offer people like a safe long-term lease and some options about what they can do in their house, that long-term renting can really work. No one's talking about it. They just want to get everyone into their own homes with a mortgage and a scary interest rate. And that would be financially crippling for me and probably a lot of other people that are in my situation. I'm a single parent and I work in the arts. What's the story? Let me know what you think. Thanks.
So PK, what do you think about Claire's question?
It's a great question, and it's a really big issue, actually, I think. So if you look at the housing system, it's broken on lots of levels. Claire, you are right. Like there are problems for renters. There are problems for people who couldn't even afford renting, so clearly need, I think, social housing, you know, provided probably by the government to help people not be homeless. Then there is the aspirations for home ownership. Then there is the affordability of homes. Like, it's multifaceted, right? At the moment, I think Labor is trying to deal with multiple fronts. They did increase, remember, rent assistance a couple of budgets ago, but their focus has been on this sort of bigger group and the dream, which is very romantic, of Australian home ownership and not dealing with the renting class. And in the last election, we saw the Greens trying to focus much more on, you know, the third of Australian voters, and it is a third, isn't it, Mel, like who are renters. Because that is like a voting block. However, they kind of went backwards a bit, the Greens, in terms of seats. So let's leave why it didn't quite work or land, or at least didn't materially result in election results for them. But if you look at the point you make, I think there is really fertile ground here. And I think that at the moment, there's been too much of a focus probably on just the home ownership part and not enough on this. And actually, watch that space. I think the government is talking, I know, because I know a lot of people in this space actually, about doing more in this area. They know that this is a big area of concern, but it's not, it doesn't have the kind of blockbuster, I deserve to own my own home optics of the other issue.
There's a really big historical cultural factor there, I feel, for a country like Australia, which has always considered itself egalitarian. If we want to go back to a European settlement story of a post-convict period, this was a point where you could come to Australia, make your fortune, be equal, that you weren't defined by whether you were from the landed gentry or whether you were a working peasant who worked for someone who owned a land. You know, I'm drawing back, you know, a good 100 years plus here, but I think there is still a bit of that that history does inform culturally where we stand on this big Australian dream of owning a home. So it's not surprising that that becomes a key focus of the political debate. I guess I think it's worth focusing though on some of those structural issues that make it harder to have those sort of long-term rentals in Australia compared to what we see in some European cities, for example. And I think that's because how we've looked at housing investment in Australia has been really different. There's really two ways to make money off investing in housing. One is the capital growth of the property. I buy it at a certain cost. I can sell it later and the profit is, you know, what I make from the difference in that. The other way you can make money is off the rental yield. How much money do I get from renting it out in the meantime? Our system in Australia is set up to make it much easier to make money from capital growth in property. You get good discounts from capital gains tax concessions. Negative gearing encourages a focus on capital growth over a longer term rental yield. And therefore, and we have a lot of mum and dad investors who are using housing as that means, and they want a bit of flexibility if that's their investment. If they've got a lot of their money and savings tied up in one big asset, and they need to access some of that money, you don't just sell a couple of shares and keep the rest of investment. You have to sell the whole property. So you want flexibility. You don't want a property locked away for 10 years. If in 5 years you might go, oh no, we've got a crisis or I've lost my job. Suddenly I need that asset. So in Australia, we're really set up for mum and dad investors, as we call it, to have a property investment that's focused on capital growth, not on rental yield. If we had a situation where our tax system was set up to be more focused on institutional investors who are looking to make money from the rental yield, then we might have more luck in getting to that European style approach of having a much greater availability of long-term renting. And look, the government might make the case that trimming back some of those incentives on capital gains tax and negative gearing might help in that regard, but I think we're still a very long way from being in a position of some of those comparator countries.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Look, let's just finally end with Zach, who asks a really great question.
Why do you think people are so upset by data centres when the federal government just recently spent billions of dollars propping up an aluminium smelter in New South Wales that uses 10% of the entire state's power supply, employs only 1,000 people, and by contrast, these data centres don't need a lick of taxpayer dollar and want to set up valuable businesses here all paid for by themselves?
All right, PK, I want to have an answer here to Zach's question because I think it's really interesting, right? Because it's a good point to put up a comparison of we've got heavy industry that uses a lot of electricity, doesn't employ a huge amount of people, but it takes up this big amount of the state's power supply. It's not so profitable that it can operate without some level of government support. And then we've got data centres who are coming here offering to set up their own energy systems, contribute to the grid. They don't need taxpayer investment as part of their business model. Why the difference in treatment? I think there's more similarities than it seems at first blush. So a lot of these smelters and other elements of heavy industry, when they were being set up, they were actually critical to helping develop big energy generators. So like our big coal-fired power generators in various parts of the country, most of them needed big long-term contracts to make it worthwhile to set up a big coal mine and a big coal generator next to it that would also supply a residential and business customers. So in many ways, to get power to your home, you needed that big commercial customer to give guarantees for the next 20 or 30 years that it would purchase X amount of power. So when we talk about the setting up of these big heavy industries decades ago, they were actually really critical to helping get that essential service online. And they do continue to help. Like, they can scale up and down their demand, which is really important when we're trying to deal with extremes in energy use, really hot days in summer, for example. I think the other thing with the smelters and heavy industry is there's not really any political debate about the usefulness of their output. Like, I think everyone agrees steel's really important, aluminium's really important. We recognise that we can't necessarily guarantee that we're always going to be able to get those resources from overseas if there's a crisis or if China wants to engage in a trade war. So, of course, we need to have some level of government support for it. I think with data centres, that's still a contested space. There are plenty of people saying, look, this is just as important as those resources. But there's still a lot of the public that are not convinced that AI is going to be a net positive on their community and on their economy. And so I think that's also makes it a politically more of a challenge for data centres to make their case.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I also think they're just going to get their own energy and they're going to get their own water and it's all going to be hunky-dory. And, you know, the government tells us they have a better plan than, for instance, happened in the US, that they've learnt the mistakes. Bit of healthy skepticism around some of this. I'm not saying they're lying to us because I don't think they are, but they haven't gone heavy-handed on requiring some of this. So it's all in the kind of, you know, requirement. I think there could be a subtle creep here. Watch that space. It will be watched very closely. I just don't know if it's going to be as hunky-dory as we think.
I think when it comes to Zach's question is that what he's talking about is exactly what is being figured out by government right now. They've gone from when Ed Husic was industry minister looking at this, he was pushing for a much more regulated approach. Under the current industry minister, Tim Ayres, there's guidelines but not compulsion. I mean, this is still clearly a dynamic regulatory environment. That sounds like a very boring bureaucratic phrase. I'm sorry that came out, but that's where we're at. How we regulate is being debated, and contested right now. We're right in the thick of the exact debate that Zach has outlined.
Yeah, I think we are in the thick of it. But also it happened without much of our consent. Like some of this stuff's been, the investment's been happening before we were having the proper debates about it, Mel. And I look at that with a degree of worry. I don't know if the public's been brought in to the extent they should have been on some of this. I think the government, I know Ed Husic was when he was a minister. I just think it dropped, you know, we didn't hear a lot about it. Now Andrew Charlton's guaranteeing us that the social license is all that, you know, going to be organised. We're not going to stuff it up. But I think we need to watch this very, very closely. I really have a strong instinct on this. One thing that Pauline Hanson said in her speech, which was not picked up on enough in my view, is more heavy-handed regulation than, did you notice that, than the Albanese government on AI.
We could do a whole nother podcast, PK, on elements from that speech that haven't got the attention that perhaps they should.
Yeah. Hanson, she's getting the anxieties around this from the community. And when she said that, I thought, you get it. Watch that space. That's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in. We love getting your questions. You send so many good questions. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
There have been so many great ones. We've covered a lot of ground today. So send in whether they're the big media issues or something from left field, send it straight in. And David Spears is going to be back with Insiders on Background on Saturday. He's speaking to the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry CEO, Andrew McKellar. He is in the thick of that discussion about tax reform. And PK, you'll be back on Monday.
Yeah, I'll be so back and I'll be in Canberra for a big sitting week. So I'll see you there, Mel. See ya.
Looking forward to it. See ya.